to stretch for a moment. I don't know, is that customary?
Not usually, but if you like.
You'll get the length of your mom talks about that.
Hugh McMillan. I'm honored to be here. I hope that I have something to offer you that you can learn something from. That may sound like an arrogant statement. It feels very humble from my point of view.
Okay,
is this working?
It's not an amplification system.
Okay.
It's just
I thought what I would offer today is a brief history of my own practice and how it has affected my life. I feel extremely grateful to this practice. I've been practicing now about 17 years, and it has changed my life enormously. And I thought perhaps in pointing to some of the things that have had those effects on me, it would be useful to some of you. When I was about 46 or 7, my life was pretty much a mess. I suppose this is a typical midlife thing. I felt like my relationships weren't going well, my parenting wasn't going well, my work life wasn't going well. I wasn't sure I was going in the right direction, if there was any. I went through a period of about 3 or 4 months of every night waking up around 2 and beginning to go through a litany of self-criticism. Each night I had a topic for the night. It was absolutely relentless, went on for months, and to the point where I was afraid to go to sleep almost. It reminded me of that cartoon in the paper, I've forgotten which one it was now, but the kid that has the terrors in the closet across from his bed. For reasons that I absolutely have nothing to say about how it happened, I decided I would start meditating. I never had meditated. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't have the slightest idea what that decision meant, but somehow I made it, and I went to a class that was kind of a smorgasbord of different meditation techniques, and fortunately one of the techniques in that class was Vipassana, and the teacher that presented that at the time was actually not an experienced practitioner, but he was a very good teacher, and at least for me. And there was an immediate connection for me because, to me, the essence of the practice is that you're given a very simple assignment, and I'm by training a scientist, so this was a very natural thing for me to sit and watch my breath. This was part of my life. But the difference was that I couldn't control anything. That was the instruction, you know, not to control anything except to try to bring my attention to the process. And whenever I lost my attention, I would just come back without self-criticism. So having just spent that 3 months in self-criticism, this looked like a wonderful opportunity to me. I would actually get to practice no self-criticism 200 or 300 times in a sitting. I mean, however many times. For me, it was a lot. I mean, mindfulness to me is brief, you know, moments in the midst of lots of other stuff. It also taught And this didn't, these teachings didn't happen instantly, but that was the immediate affinity I had to the practice, was that very simple process. And for me, the relief of practicing no self-criticism and no control. For some reason, I immediately knew this is what I wanted to do. And somehow, a trust came in that, that this was what I was going to do. Some kind of a commitment I made to myself. Even though the rewards were very slow in coming, somehow I stayed with it. And in along the way, that taught me patience, which I hadn't had much of. And it also taught me an acceptance of myself and the benefits of non-doing. This is pretty radical practice from a Western point of view, I think, and I don't know why it had such an affinity for me, but I really feel like those things I've just mentioned, all of those formed a cornerstone for me that has incrementally changed my life. Patience, acceptance, non-criticism, no control. And very early on, also, the Four Noble Truths had an immediate strong connection to me because of the very direct, pragmatic pointing towards suffering as the human condition. I had taken my suffering very personally up till then. I could see it all as being self-inflicted and results of lots of bad choices of lifestyle and lots of in the Buddhist picture, I'm definitely a greedy personality, and I wanted to experience everything, no matter what the cost. Although I was also deluded and aversive, but mostly greedy. The other thing that had a very strong connection early on in my practice was the way that the precepts are framed. I was raised in a quite strict Protestant household by the standards of the 50s, very strict. But I could never connect two commandments and faith in some external being. And the precepts immediately frame things in terms of intention. And for me, and not only do they frame things in terms of intention, but they raise the bar, in my view, so high compared to the commandments that they really cut away a lot of stuff. I mean, just as an example, the intention, the precept about which in the Western culture is about stealing, in the precept is about not taking anything that's not freely offered, which includes, in my mind at least, any forms of psychological control, as well as material possessions. It's a much more demanding code of conduct, and yet it's framed in a way that one can start out very unskilled and just have an intention. And very diabolically, this intention begins to transform your whole form of conduct, because if you can hold to the intention, you begin to see more and more unskillful action in yourself, at least I could. And I began to realize the ramifications of this. But along with that comes a much quieter mind. That became clear pretty quickly, that the more one can practice the precepts, the quieter the mind can get, because it's not filled with lots of self-recrimination and regret. And and of course, as my practice went along, then the Eightfold Path began to make more sense. And then something that I think from our Western point of view we don't get taught a lot, which is I think we almost, most of us at least, in my experience, come to this practice, myself certainly, sitting first. Meditation is kind of the core of the practice. And but in Asia and with the monastic tradition, morality and generosity, sila and dana, are taught first as a cornerstone of the practice, and meditation comes last. And what morality and generosity do is to establish a peaceful mind so that meditation can actually take hold. I mean, my experience sitting was I could be mindful for a microsecond, and then my mind would go off immediately into some unskillful action I'd done that day. And if I sat long enough, it'd be going back to the week before and the week before that. And my mind was completely filled with, in sitting, with reevaluations of all of my actions. Now, that was very helpful, but it was also very torturous. And as I began to get my life cleaned up in terms of my actions, my mind got quieter. It was a very important experience for me. One of the problems I had fairly early in my practice was I didn't know how to take this practice into my daily life very well. I mean, I think it was affecting my behavior, but I want to share a very story that was very, very important to me, told by a person at Green Gulch about his own law practice, in which he had been hired into a firm in San Francisco primarily because of his family connections. And he was not a very important member in this law firm, and he felt at risk all the time. And he was, and he also had a practice, and there was a lot of standing around the water cooler telling off-color and racist jokes, probably sexist jokes too, but this was a while ago. And he was very uncomfortable with that, but he didn't know what to do about it. He was frightened. He felt so insecure in his job, he didn't actually know how to not be at the water cooler. But he made the intention to do that, and so he stopped coming to the water cooler. And he was quite fearful about the ramifications of that. But in fact, what happened was one of the people in the law firm noticed this and came to him and talked to him about it, and decided that this fellow, whose name was Bill, he would give him a pro bono case he had that he hadn't had time to work on. And as I recall, it involved the International Hotel in the city and the difficulties of those low-income people to stay there. And he took that case, and he really got into this case, and he won the case. And he said it was the first experience in his life where he'd actually somehow lined up his intentions and his morality and his work. And I think it was the first time he'd won a case. And slowly but surely, over a number of years, he began to take on more and more of these cases, and he actually built his entire practice out of what are relatively pro bono cases, and became a leading member of that law firm. And I found that story very inspiring, but it did require trust and taking a risk. And so I began to think about how what was needed in my work place and what I'd been learning in my practice. And I realized, I have a little list here I'm going to share with you, that I felt was very coincident, my practice and my work, but I just hadn't been able to see it before until I'd heard Bill's story. just to review what I've talked about up till now, intention. Intention in lots of little steps. Slowly wakening to the possibilities and the needs for correct action. Involves commitment and trust that it's going to work out. Patience. And an open mind and non-judgment. Integrity and compassion. And honoring oneself and others. I began to actually utilize those things at work, and I had an opportunity because my boss quit, and I decided I would ask for that job, and I was given it, and I decided that the cornerstone of my job as boss, I had about 15 people working for me, would be that I would be in service to them, that would be the point of departure for my job. And I'm very proud of that period of my life. There was a lot of bad morale in this place I was working, and people were unhappy and leaving, and those kinds of things were going on, and that stopped. We became a very cohesive group, and I think the cornerstone of it was that I really set the intention of serving the people that worked for me as my first priority, and I think they sensed that in some way. They seemed to flourish with that. So, as a consequence, that's just an example about my work life, but I feel like my whole life has come more into focus with this practice. Somehow, this very slow setting of intentions begins to create a framework in one's mind where I began to actually take more and more and more responsibility for my life, for the consequences of my actions, thought about them more ahead of time, in many ways became progressively a little more skillful, and it's made a big difference. I can't remember what it was like before. I would like to make one comment beyond that. That's I would say, those are the remedial benefits of practice. They can do the things that other forms of self-help can do or claim to be able to do. I haven't found that to be the case. This has been the only thing for me. But there is something beyond this remedial work that I want to point toward, which is the all during my first years of practice, this was enough for me. I just wanted to feel better. I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to just have a better life. But as I began to practice longer, go on retreats, sit longer periods, the really inspiring and encouraging foundations of this practice, which have to do with freedom, with real freedom, and with the understanding of how interconnected the world is and how we are all one being together, that provide an inspiration that's way beyond this remedial kind of fix. I'm just beginning all of this, but I've been very, very happy about it so far. So, thank you. Are there any questions? Yes?
You and I met you last week. Eventually, had a good view to me in the parking lot of Whole Foods. I was about to pull out of the parking lot, and this man took me, "Hold on." And his van was next to me, and apparently some people were walking by, and I would have run them over. And I was so appreciative of that simple act. And then I came to the Sangha last week, and he was sweet. It was him. And I thought, this world is too small. But in talking to you, he mentioned to me that that you support the monastics with food, and I wondered if you would tell us a little bit about that. I'm interested.
Sure.
How that came about.
I left a lot. I have to try to be short about this, but I left a lot out of the talk, of course. But after my first 3 or 4 years of practice, I didn't have a teacher. And I think Joseph Goldstein said about himself one time, if you don't have a teacher for a while, you learn that it's important to have a teacher. And it takes a long time, but you finally get it. And I was going up to Green Gulch for daily, for one day service now and then. And one day I went up there, and Jack Kornfield was scheduled to do a one-day sitting, and he introduced Ajahn Sumedho, who was there. For those of you who weren't at last week's thing here, Ajahn Sumedho is an American who trained in Thailand for about 10 years, then became head of the Western Monastery in Thailand under Ajahn Chah for about 10 years, and then went to England, and where he started a monastery in England, and now that has become several monasteries, and now recently a monastery in Ukiah. Well, Ajahn Sumedho, I've never really believed in the idea of gurus, especially a devotional type worship, but as a teacher, I had an immediate connection. I said, this guy, of course, he's in England, you know, so I'm going to pick this guy as my teacher. That's not very realistic. But it turns out he came here every year and gave retreats, and some of his other monks did also. So, in fact, he was accessible. And then over time, they put this monastery together. And so I go up to the monastery in Ukiah when I can. And they're building a monastery. I mean, it started out being a 50-style ranch house with an old barn. In fact, the barn had been used to cure marijuana, so they got this piece of land for quite a reasonable price. So they have about 250 acres, and we are building the buildings that they will need, including Dhamma Hall and quarters for the monks and eventually nuns. And there's a sangha that I've come to know through this that's spread around Northern California that's probably a couple hundred people. And the monks, as part of the monk's life, for those of you who don't know, monks cannot do anything for themselves. They cannot have money. They cannot... they're only allowed to have the clothing suitable protect themselves from the cold, and a roof, and all food must be provided by the lay people. And this was Buddha's instruction, and it means that if the monastics become withdrawn from the public, they don't get fed. They cannot store food, so they don't get fed today. So there's a very immediate relationship that develops between the lay people and the monastics, where the lay people are wanting spiritual guidance from the monastics, and the monastics are literally depending on their well-being, the lay people. So it's a very compelling contract. And there are many, many ways that people provide this kind of support. Some people do it mostly in the forms of money. Some people bring up a full meal and offer it for the noonday meal. Some people come up and cook food that they or other people have brought. There are lots of possibilities because the monastics cannot cook or store food or buy food. And when the leftovers at the end of the day they're given away. So the monastic has to completely surrender to the possibility of that nothing will happen tomorrow.
One fine point of that. Okay, so they can have the money through the Sangha Palafan Foundation.
Yes, but they cannot handle the money. Right,
yeah,
only
right,
the lay people handle the money.
But obviously they're not going to starve to death, right? Because as long as people continue giving to that entity, is that right? That food comes for them through that foundation? Or?
Well, the priorities of the money are not to spend it on food, but if necessary, it will be spent on food. But if the money is to be spent on food, then some layperson who's there at the time has to decide, hey, there's no food today. I'm going to have to go downtown and buy some and prepare the meal for them, because the monks literally cannot get into even asking for food or suggesting that maybe somebody should run downtown because there isn't any food. They just have to be.
People there to kind of watch. I mean, I hate to think that there's any possibility they would start. There's people that are checking in, and I hope.
Well, I mean,
that road is
yes,
an accessible road.
Our mind goes there. Yes, that's a possibility.
Do they ever go on a walk to the Amazon from
Asia? Yeah, they do. They have. They've been there now 4 years, I guess. And the first couple of years they did not do that, but now as the community of, as a local community of people has grown, they now make alms rounds down into Redwood Valley, which is about 5 miles away. And they actually, it's not, you know, in Asia you walk down the road and the people, it's an appointed place and the villagers come out and line this road and offer the food. There are not that many people in Redwood Valley that are currently doing that, so it's more a matter of going directly to a house where a meal is offered. And I actually have not been on those alms rounds, so I don't know if there's actually a, you know, a cold call kind of a part of it. I don't think there is. Yes.
I'm finding myself very curious if there have ever been studies of incidents of clinical depression in the monastic people, given that there's a huge correlation between lack of control in one's life and increased incidence of depression. I'm just curious.
In my limited experience in the monks I've known, of course, this is not incarceration. If you decide to drop out, you can drop out. So there might be a pre-selection going on here. I mean, there have been in Ukiah a number of young men who've come for the first level of training, which is anagarika level, and there have been about a half a dozen, roughly, and for the most part, they have eventually dropped out. They've stayed 2 or 3 years. For one reason or another, they've dropped out. So I can't speak to the reasons, individual reasons, but it's my impression that depression was not one of them. But my personal experience with sitting long times is joy rather than depression. The very realization that there was a very interesting piece in the paper recently by John Carroll about the distinction between control and power. And I think that it's powerlessness that makes people depressed, not lack of control. Because we actually don't control anything important in our lives. And if we understand that, then it gets a lot easier. I think it's a very basic part of the practice when you start sitting longer periods that you begin to really see that this idea of non-control is actually much, much better than control. And so, but there are certainly, I've heard stories of monks that were depressed. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen. But
some of it might be mediated by the teachings of letting go of self-criticism, which is the other big part of depression.
Yes.
As you were developing your practice and you were still involved in business, did you find that, particularly after you became the boss, but you were relating to other bosses, that sometimes you felt like your practice was almost antithetical to the sort of values of business. I find myself, for instance, the discussion of power and control. When you have that kind of conversation with people in business, it kind of freaks them out. And they kind of think like you're the person who says things like that is losing it and is kind of a dangerous person. And it's really interesting in my practice to, in business, to watch that reaction and be very careful, you know, how it comes out in business, because there's a lot of judgment based on the non-belief in control, for instance. And I find it interesting and takes a lot of patience and almost stealth. Yeah.
Well, there is this idea in right speech that it has to be that the person has to be ready to hear it as well as that it's correct. Well, there are two things in answering that question for me. One is that I worked in a research lab, and the corporate ambition in a research lab isn't for power. It's for notoriety. It's publishing papers and being thought of as a good scientist. It's not about running everybody. So So in that context, the idea of teamwork and caring for each other worked very well. If people were stepping on people, that would be a tougher challenge. But I think it's still possible to create that kind of environment. At least my immediate bosses were very much of that type, but I saw my job as shielding my people from their escapades. and they recognized that effort on my part and greatly appreciated it. I ended up kind of trying to be the buffer for all that kind of stuff. But
what was your boss's reaction to this contention on your part?
I didn't declare it. I just.
But did they sense there was a friction or a problem?
I had another benefit which hasn't occurred to me until right now, which was that I was older than my boss. And that's a great benefit. I was bigger than he was too. but men unconsciously pay tribute to those things. So when I would give him a gentle scolding about something from the standpoint of being older and bigger, you know, he could take it in a different light than if I was coming on in some brash, ambitious way. Because I really did have his best interest at heart as well. I mean, what I found for myself was if I was in a difficult situation. Oh, another thing I learned immediately from this practice was in a meeting where people are going at each other, it is not a requirement that you have to say what you want to say in that meeting. It can be said later, and oftentimes to much greater effect. I used to have this idea that when somebody started misbehaving, you had to nail them right now. And I would say unskillful things in an effort to get control of the situation. When I realized, and I came to see the practice immediately, I can just go sit home. I can sit on this for a few days, literally sit on it, and a skillful action will come out of that sitting. And it did, invariably, eventually. I would start to see it from a larger picture and see a way to resolve the issue. And then going to people in private and talking to them in general was much more effective because no one was being put on the spot. And But I didn't make any declarations that I'm a Buddhist, everybody's going to be Buddhist now. I mean, I didn't do anything like that. You know, I mean, that seems very unskillful. Yes.
What was the effect, if you're willing to say, on your parenting?
Well, it's still going on. I mean, my youngest my children are grown now. My youngest is 32. She's now going to therapy and coming home from every therapy session and giving me something more to work on. I don't think it ever ends. That's my take so far, anyway. I think it just gradually got better. But then when I've been retired now for 9 years, and I am almost 10. And of course, this word retirement, I don't know what it means, but I made the conscious decision after I retired that I wanted to devote myself to my family and to this practice and to friends. And so what happened for my family was that things came up that needed a lot more attention than just incidental time. My father was getting close to death and very concerned about a lot of issues, so I just went and lived with him for a few months. And my brother had a real serious tax problem, and I just went and we made out tax returns for about 4 months, and I suddenly realized I had this time that I could do things for my family that I'd never been able to do before because I was going to work every day. And as I became available, the opportunities came forward. And what it did is, I don't think this requires retirement, but as I became more open, my kids became eager to heal anything that had happened. And so it worked together to just be a lot better. Still working, but in progress. Yes.
I don't know how to put this, but to be speaking to be in the present moment as much as possible. Less regard for the past and not too much into expectations for the future. And personally, I happen to be having the experience of a new relationship, and that word has been used about no expectations and present moment. And I have a bit of bewilderment about that in relation to commitment, that the big C word. And I don't know how to do that path. I don't know how to. Now, obviously, I'm in this kind of limbo time right now, but I don't see how that comes together. I don't quite understand how you can have both being in the moment and some kind of thought that the F word is the future word. How do I go? Any thought that
there could be a future and just really stick with this moment. It seems like it's easy to do in other areas of the practice and of living, but it's a little tricky that you care about. But I care. I spared you all of my wrecked relationships. I didn't think you'd really want to hear about them. So, we're our own worst enemies in this area. I think the grasping that we all feel arising around something that we want usually destroys what we want, and so it's I don't think it's not a matter of eradicating the thoughts. The thoughts are going to arise. One of my teachers says all the time, this is the easiest thing in the world, this practice. When anybody asks you a question, you just say, be mindful. That's all you ever have to say. But in fact, it is all you ever have to say. I mean, these emotions arise, and we have to be aware of them in order to decide what we're going to do about them. And sometimes they warrant action and sometimes they don't. And we have to decide that. And I think the guidance for deciding is intention. You know, what are my intentions here? And are they really for everybody's best interests, or are they just for my own selfish best interests or my own fears? And to, you know, cross-examine yourself in those terms so that your actions can be as skillful as possible. But there's no... this practice isn't about not making commitments. I would say quite the contrary. So it's maybe making it at the right time and with the right person. But is that at all helpful?
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm just beginning the path of retirement. You could say a few more words about how the last 9 years have been for you in retirement. Talked about families being there for them. Is that the core of what you've been doing with other things? How has it been leaving the 40-hour week and entering your own pastor kind of a time?
I thought when I stopped working that I would, that within 6 months I'd go get another job. What happened for me was I had gotten to a point in my life where I decided that I wanted to do something a little different, and I didn't know exactly how I was going to accomplish that because I had, in this research environment, I was the guy who went out and got the money. And I had those relationships in Washington and stuff, and none of my people that worked for me wanted to leave the lab. They all wanted to stay in the lab and let me go get the money. And so I didn't really know what I was going to do about this dilemma. And one day I came to work and they announced that we'd been sold, and so my problems were over. Like that. And I had made an intention to myself to go on a long retreat, but I had to just make myself available for this sale process, which took about a year. And literally, the sale process, I just had to trust that it would work. And the sale process finished the week before my youngest two graduated from college. And like 5 days after that, I went on this retreat. So in letting go of this whole thing and just doing what needed to be done, somehow this miraculous timing took place. So I went on this retreat with this question that you've got, you know, foremost in my mind. And it never came up on the retreat. Never came up. It was the darndest thing. But other things came up. I had a continual nightmare about my son being in an accident. Well, a week after the retreat was over, my granddaughter got run over by a truck, and my son never got in the accident, but my granddaughter got run over by this truck. And so suddenly I had this thing I had to go do, which I could do now. And so it was more like one thing led to another, and along the way I began to realize this is really where I wanted to put my effort. It wasn't like I sat back and made a big plan. I think it helped. And during that period there was a lot of questioning from my peers. What do you mean you're not doing anything? And if I go to a party and people would say, well, what do you do? Which is, I'd say nothing. I practiced saying nothing and watched how they responded. It was a serious conversation killer. You know, I mean, it really What I saw in people was either a flash of, you can't get away with that. Or, you know, or, well, you're not interesting, I'm out of here. But, you know, but it was really interesting to watch how much stuff people carry around this. I mean, it's, myself included. And so I made a really conscious effort to start kind of deprogram myself. I actually, I'm a big multitasker. I'm going to go downtown to get a haircut. So while I'm there, I might as well do the hardware store and the grocery market. And I would start doing all these trips, and I'd race around. Oh, it's almost lunchtime. I don't want to be down during the lunchtime. The traffic's going to be terrible. I'd race around, and I'd get home. I'd say, what the hell was I doing down there? And so I made myself do one errand at a time for a few months just to kind of just slow down. So that was, you know, 40 years of work life. It took a while to... That's not 30 years of work life. So it took a while to... come to an understanding, and it was never obvious where it was going to go. I kept thinking I was going to go back to work one of these days, and at some point I realized, huh, I guess I'm not going to do that.
So there's no sort of 5-year plan or anything like that. The present moment is, as you said.
I think what I've taken from this practice is that I make plans, but I don't adhere to them. I have some ideas about directions. I particularly have intentions about immediate directions and some bigger. I mean, I've made a conscious decision where I was going to put my effort. And occasionally I'll say, well, let me review that. You know, I'll go check out new possibilities, and sometimes I'll act on, sometimes I won't. But I know for myself that my tendency is to get overcommitted. And so I definitely don't want to go too far that way and then have to pull back. I would rather be a little undercommitted rather than to have to keep saying, oh, I've signed up for too much, I got to quit this. It's just my own preference, but that's just my own preference. But it's more about, I think, intentions. To keep coming back to that word, trying to really decide what's important. And sitting on a retreat is invaluable in this. But it just keeps coming up. The things that are troublesome keep coming up. Thank you all.